Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and it's with a little bit of sadness that I bring this podcast to you because after the best part of what feels like about 5.5 years, about 15,000 miles and countless journeys, bumps, internet issues, trauma and anything else you want to throw at it, this is the last ever episode of the South America Files. The City's version. It's been done in two halves. It's been epic. So before we get to the very last place, because obviously Gary will give you one of his really easy clues in a minute as to where we went. And if you listen to the last episode, which was probably about a month ago, you'll remember where we're going based on his clues. But if not, Gary will give you another clue in a minute. So first of all, Gary, welcome to the last one. How are you feeling?
Yeah, a little bit sad, but we'll towards the end of the end of this podcast, we'll have a little bit of a positive thing and a bright look towards the future.
You've been very cryptic there. You've not even given us a remote clue as to where we're going tonight.
Can't give too much away. Can't give too much away, buddy. All settled. I mean, you know, that's an Indian. You know, we have so much fun doing these that we can't stop.
Stand by for the Yorkshire Files.
Starting in all.
Yeah, so but when we get to the end of this podcast, we'll have a little bit of an announcement to make about our next project.
Okay, do you want to give a little teaser about where we're heading on this on this last leg of this epic journey?
About 6 months ago, we left Rosario.
Yeah, we did. Yeah,
the 2,000 kilometer journey to where we're going now has taken quite a while. I think we took a longer winding path to get to where we are. We've just arrived at the airport. International Governor Andre Franco Montoro, which is more commonly known, fortunately, as the airport Guarulhos. The city we're in was founded in 1554 by Manuel do Nobrega and Joseph of Anchieta. With a population of 12.5 million people, it's the most populous city in the Americas, it's the most populous city in the Western Hemisphere, and the most populous city in the Southern Hemisphere, as well as being the fourth largest by population. It's the birthplace of many notable people, including a whole grid of Formula One drivers, with the likes of Ayrton Senna, Felipe Massa, Rubens Barrichello, and both the brothers Emerson and Christian Fittipaldi, all hailing from the city. Brazilian World Cup heroes, Dilma Santos, Rivellino and Cafu, plus Vicente Fiola, who coached Brazil to the World Cup triumph in 1958, were also born here. And to complete the picture, it's also the birthplace of Mike Krieger. And the reason I say to complete the picture is because he's the guy who's co-founded Instagram. So we're rounding out our South American odyssey in the Brazilian city of São Paulo.
Wow. I don't think you needed to give away where we were going, Gary. I think they got it from that. I can't believe with the four of us, I'm saying you really, Gary, that between us, we couldn't even get the internet work to work. And now we're knowledgeable about the founder of Instagram and all sorts of stuff. We'll be Snapchatting each other soon doing these podcasts. Okay, now, luckily for us, we have the same two co-hosts. So first of all, Stephen Scragg. Now, Stephen, just because this is the last episode, it's like a free hit. That doesn't mean to say that you can just go all in on any fans who are listening from any club whatsoever.
This feels edgy. This feels a bit Zinedine Zidane in the 2006 World Cup final, this does. I'm fully expecting some kind of headbutt to fly in and family insults to be thrown around.
I feel like it feels like a hair trigger tonight. I feel like it could just go off at any second.
At the minute, I feel quite serene about it, but I'm under no illusions that it could turn very, very quickly.
And obviously, luckily for the three of us, we've had this guy with us for the whole journey because God knows where we would have ended up if we hadn't had him with us. Pete, welcome to the last leg of the journey of what feels like the Rolling Stones' final world tour that just never ends.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the kind of tail end is joking, is that this is the inaugural final tour before another final tour and another one. And I think also we should give apologies. You know, there are certain people in cities all across South America who have been desperately hoping that their city was going to be mentioned. So I think we need to apologise to the fine people of Quito, of Barranquilla, of Caracas, of Valparaiso, of Córdoba, of La Paz, whose teams and cities failed to make it into this epic journey. So maybe that'll be on the next, you know, final tour. We'll do them as well. You know, I mean, you know, maybe, you know, maybe we're going to do villages of South American football next. You know, who knows?
Well, maybe there's rumours of a Christmas DVD version of this podcast series. Maybe we'll just do it then. Maybe it'll be in the Christmas special that we've got lined up. So it's with a, well, everything's going to be with a heavy heart. Well, apart from Stephen, but other than that, everything else will be with a heavy heart tonight, because really, for the last time, we're all going to be educated by you, Pete, in a sec, about the history of this city, the football, how it was established, its impact, and all the other wonderful, wonderful things that I currently don't know, but in about 15 minutes' time, I actually am going to know. But luckily for you, there isn't an exam at the end of this series, because that would actually, the thought of it has just made me panic a little bit, actually. When I think about all the things you've done in your opening pieces, if ever there was going to be an exam at the end, I would be properly panicked. I was one of those students who absorbed it, took the interesting bits and forgot everything else. But anyway, so over to you, Pete, for the last time, the history of football in Sao Paulo.
I mean, I worry that you've given me 15 minutes to do this. I mean, I'm used to kind of lecturing for an hour. So, you know, you've given me a big time thing there. Anyway, so Sao Paulo then, I think this is one of those places that has the kind of myth origins of, you know, Charles Miller as being one of the kind of British pioneers of football, you know, in South America. Southampton fans will see Charles Miller, obviously a former Southampton player in the Southampton St. Mary's days, as being, you know, the great person who taught the Brazilians how to play. He apparently did bring football to Sao Paulo, and there was a game played, one of the first games in Sao Paulo, according to the rules anyway, was played at the Sao Paulo Athletic Club, when Charles Player got some of his friends and cronies to out on the field to have a game. I mean, I've just been reading a great book called Sports in South America by Matthew Brown, and he actually writes that football may well have been played some 15 years before that, introduced by a Spaniard called Jose Mantero, who's a Jesuit priest who'd been on tour in Europe and had seen football played at Harrow School and Van School in France. And we'd actually introduced football to the Colegio São Luís, which is in a place called Itu, which is in Sao Paulo province. And he suggests that maybe some of the kids that were at that school and first learned how to control a leather ball might have been responsible to help the growth of football in Sao Paulo after that. But anyway, that's a kind of interesting story that kind of maybe debunks or at least challenges these kind of myths of the British football pioneers. The first ever kind of Sao Paulo football tournament, after it first got played by the Sao Paulo Athletic Club, featured that particular club in 1901 alongside Internacional, Mackenzie College, Sport Club Germania and Paulistano. So Sport Club Germania is interesting because it was founded by a guy called Hans Nobeling, who was German, which again kind of disrupts this idea of it was just British people who took football around the continent. And that's actually something we've seen in different cities, that it's not just the Brits that have brought football there. The first match was played at Parque Antártica, not kind of, you know, very away ground by the Antarctic, but named after that because there was a beer company nearby. And that was between Germania and Mackenzie College. So that was the first one. Unfortunately, none of those clubs have really made it through to the current day, although they're kind of some of their clubs that have kind of had their origins, that, you know, you can see the legacies of the clubs in different ones. And that's the case of Paulistano, who were really one of the great football clubs of Brazil in the first 30 years or so, but then didn't make it through the amateur area. They were a team that won a lot of tournaments, but then decided that they didn't want to go professional. And then gradually, as their players left, they really stopped playing football as a social club. But they did manage to win the Paulista League in four times consecutively in the brief time they were in existence, which is the most of any of the... I think that's the most and the only time it's been done. One of the clubs that emerged from that team, Paulistano, or Sao Paulo, originally named after the city itself. They were formed in 1930, and they're the club that play at the Morumbi Stadium. It's got a record of attendance of nearly 140,000 people, a little bit squashed for them on that particular day. They're known as the Tricolor Paulista, or the Club of the Faith, or the Sovereigns. Their badge was originally designed by a German called Walter Ostrich, which is just a great little fact, which is worth mentioning. Again, their club hymn, and again, most of these clubs will have hymns, was composed by an army lieutenant who was afraid that he was going to lose his house, and so composed a song kind of to cheer himself up. So, you know, fans of other clubs that have been struggling, now you know what to do to help your clubs out in the forthcoming years. Let's go on to some of the other bigger clubs that have made or do dominate the leagues now. Palmeiras are one of the biggest clubs. They were formerly Palestra Italia. We'll talk a little bit about their origins later on. But they changed their name during the Second World War. We'll talk about why that is a little bit later on. They're known as the Green Parrot or the Pig. Slightly big of an identity crisis of which animals they go for. The pig nickname actually emerges from 1969 when, unfortunately, two Corinthians players died in a car crash, and Palmeiras refused Corinthians the chance to sign any more players because the signing deadline had passed. So they were always known as the Pigs after that. But then they've kind of embraced the nickname, as many other clubs have done so. Corinthians, which is a club we just mentioned there, again, founded by railway workers, one of the few clubs that doesn't have elite origins in Sao Paulo. They had to kind of struggle to get into the league, which was mostly hosted by these elite clubs in the early years. And when they managed to do that, they put up this poster or banner saying, this team will last, because so many of the clubs that were formed around Sao Paulo at the time, in the different barrios, by factories, by friends in schools, in the different kind of areas around the floodplains of Sao Paulo, had failed to make it. But they guaranteed they would do. They're inspired by the tours of the great Corinthians club from Britain, and they've managed to last, which is great to their credit. Some of the other teams that are worth mentioning as well are Portuguesa. Again, one of the big five of Sao Paulo League. They've managed to win the league on a couple of occasions. They very much represent the Portuguese community of Sao Paulo at the time. We could also talk about Juventus. No, not that one. And what makes Juventus slightly odd is that they're a workers' team founded by people from Turin, but actually they play in the colours of Torino, because the owner, Rodolfo Crespi, or the original owner's son, actually happened to be a Torino fan while he was a Juventus fan. So they kept the name, but had the Torino kit, which is a bit unusual. There's also another team called Nacional, founded in 1919 by employees of the British Railway Company in Sao Paulo. Again, we've seen a lot of clubs called Nacional in the past. And I want to finish with one particular team called Scottish Wanderers. One of the slightly most teams that were in disrepute at the particular time. They were workers who were hired by the J&P Coates textile mill around Sao Paulo. But all of them apparently happened to be quite good footballers. And this kind of caused a lot of consternation around 1914 to 1917, more or less, in the kind of various local amateur and factory leagues, while suddenly these Scottish semi-pro footballers turned up and started beating everyone and also were expecting to be paid as well. So actually, you know, there was quite a bit of consternation about this kind of under-the-table professionalism, and the Scottish Wanderers sadly stopped playing in 1917. There are a huge amount of other clubs, again, representing different barrios, different neighbourhoods. There's some great articles about how Futebol de Varzela, the kind of football of the floodplains, was such a huge phenomenon. We have socialist teams, we have anarchist teams, we have factory teams, we have diaspora teams. They all, you know, are there and make up the incredible, colourful and vibrant footballing atmosphere of Sao Paulo.
Oh, brilliant, Pete. Absolutely brilliant. It's why we bought you on this trip of ours. incredible. Now, obviously, I've made a few notes on the bits that interested me. Now, Gary, I've got a great question for you to kick off with.
Uh-oh.
I wasn't expecting to ask you this question until Pete opened up with this. Now, obviously, the story of Charles Miller and this introduction of or giving football to the Brazilians, blah, 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 blah. So my question to you, Gary, and obviously based on the article that that Pete talked about, is it difficult or too difficult to change popular history in terms of these sorts of things? Will it be forever Charles Miller, or do you think these things can be changed?
Great question, Stu. It's another great question, but I guess these legends take on a life of their own, don't they? You know, and it's one of these things that can, well, I would say, can't ever be proved one way or t'other. But that vagueness of history allows that legend to become, you know, set in stone. So, yeah, I think it will be difficult to change. I came across the same two guys that Pete mentioned. Also, another guy who was mentioned that same game that Pete mentioned Charles Miller played in is Rio Oscar Cox. There must be some kind of Portuguese-English amalgam somewhere on the line. It's interesting that game, that 14 April 1895, the railway team played the gas company. The railway team stayed on track, but the gas ran out of power in the second half and lost 4-2.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I just want to flag up another couple of teams I mentioned. I found out about one particular because this team called São Caetano, they've got a really fascinating little history. And when we come to the games, I'm going to mention one of their games. A lot of fascinating history about them. And another couple of teams are Barcelona, as well as a Juventus, there's also Barcelona in Sao Paulo. And they play in the Blaugrana kit of the Barcelona. And although they're sort of fairly low ranked than the Paulista Serie B, Diego Costa started his career there. And the other one is Fernandopolis, which I think is a great name. And there's a guy we might touch on afterwards who played for so many of the teams. I think he played for five teams in Sao Paulo across the years, and this is one of them. But they were founded in 1961. A lot of the teams, the modern teams, Sao Caetano were founded in 1989. So it's interesting, a lot of new teams in. I've drifted off the subject a bit, mate. Sorry about that, but you know. Sao Caetano, because I think that's a brilliant little story we'll pick up on afterwards about that club.
It's like I say, it's the last episode, and really, this is like a free hit. You can get anything you want off your chest in this episode.
Do you want the list of all the Sao Paulo clubs that have won the second and third divisions? Because I've got them all written out. If you want them,
of course you are, Peter.
I can't believe you've written them. I cannot believe you don't know them. I'm not gonna lie, I'm a little bit disappointed.
There's about 30 odd. Just so you know.
So Caetano, though, particularly because they got to the Copa Libertadores final as well. But you know, not long after they were created. So, but anyway, we'll come back to that afterwards.
It's great, and the question for you, Stephen, is it's a similar question that Spurs gets asked. But obviously, we've done, I want to say 14 episodes, but it might be 15. I can't remember. I think it's 15. And this final one, I mean, as Pete's mentioned, there we've got railway workers, textile workers, factory workers. It almost encapsulates everything that we've spoken about. Not only in the South America files, the countries, South America files, the cities. It's almost like it's a picture perfect final episode of the early days of football in South America.
Yeah, it's the proper postcard image. You know, this is it really. This is kind of the city that, you know, inspired all of this. You know, they've got so much going for it. You know, in all sorts of directions, be it on the pitch, off the pitch. The histories, you know, the clubs that went defunct because, you know, the amateur era came to an end. You know, it's just got, you know, a magnificent, almost stereotypical South American tapestry to it. But there's so much more. There's so much more.
I'm gonna throw you a curveball question here, Steve, because it's just popped in my head, and I'm clearly in the mood for it in this particular podcast. Can you put your finger on the difference between how football, you can interpret it however you want, is either feels or is perceived in cities in Brazil compared to cities in Argentina?
From a sizable distance, I would say that Brazilian football comes from the heart, comes from the soul, whereas Argentinian football, it's somewhat, you know, it's still beautiful and all of that, but I think it's a bit more aspirational than Brazilian football is. No, Brazilian football traditionally is, you know, very much, you know, it's you know, we want to go stereotypes, but it's the samba beat. We all look at the 82 World Cup and the way that the football is played to the beat of the drum from the crowd and all of that, you know, and we all buy into it. But there's a lot of truth in that. You know, there's an exaggerated stereotype there, but, you know, you have to have a germ of truth to be able to come up with that, you know, that exaggerated stereotype. You know, we've spoken many times throughout this series about how that there is that pecking order, there is that, you know, hierarchy in South American football, and, you know, Brazil, you know, out there with all those World Cup successes and everything that's involved there, and, you know, for Argentina, it's keeping up with the Joneses, but also looking further afield and, know, we've spoken about the European influences in a way, and the way that they look to Europe almost and say, like, this is, you know, we want to be a bit more cosmopolitan about this. There you go. Maybe that's it. You know, Argentina is more cosmopolitan, but, you know, Brazil has the soul.
That's a great answer.
Do you want me to add to it? That's a really good. The cosmopolitan bit's a really, really good point. I think that what you look at is what social processes and historical processes are going on at the times where football is kind of founded and who by, and what's going historically at the time. So I think one of the things that's really interesting about Brazil is that you have a country that is trying to assimilate a kind of slavery population. You know, the slavery is abolished in 1888, I think it is, in Brazil. So you've got kind of the early years of football being introduced at the same time as kind of blacks, mulattos, pardos are being assimilated into what the Brazilian nation is. And as the kind of, you know, the elite or the ideas of elite football is being processed, you know, they're also, you know, they've got this kind of population that's starting to become involved in social affairs and are moving from plantations potentially more into the cities. You have this coffee boom as well in Brazil, which is kind of stimulating the economy and meaning that people are starting to move towards towns because business is being created there. So you've got not just the kind of the, you know, the Brazilian elites and some European elites that have come from Europe. And again, you've probably got a Portuguese community. You've definitely got an Italian community. There's a smaller German community. We talked a little bit about that in Porto Alegre, but you've got the black community as well, the kind of the slave populations from the past who are, you know, so football is very much a process in Brazil of trying to assimilate those kind of ideas into a kind of integrated nation, I suppose. Argentina is similar as well. I think that certainly they see themselves as being much more cosmopolitan, as Stevie said. You know, you've got much more of a British population, the kind of white population. I think that there are Afro-Argentinians, and there's a book by a guy called Mark Orton, who's written a book called Football and Nation Building in Argentina, I think it is, La Nuestra. And he talks about this process of trying to assimilate Brits into it and, you know, dealing with that kind of community, but also a lot of Italian and Spanish communities, which, and the Spanish community aren't really there in Brazil. So, you know, they've got this kind of modernizing idea, this industrializing idea. They're looking a little bit more towards Northern Europe, maybe, as their ideas. So I guess that you've got social processes that are different and historical ideals that are different, you know, at this particular time. And that maybe frames in a lot of ways the way that identities are created. And I think it's also important to say that we're slightly generalizing about, for example, maybe how Sao Paulo is compared to Rio, because I think there are different identities there. And then obviously within Buenos Aires, that's very much its own identity, whereas the kind of the cities and the provinces, you know, like Cordoba, like Rosario, who aren't the capital, will also have a slightly different identity and slightly different social processes. Although certain things like railways, nation building, you know, urbanization are all kind of key factors between all these different countries, you know, and what's going on.
That's great. Great work, guys. I do have, by the way, I'm going to warn you, I've got two really controversial questions for you towards the end. You might be able to guess what they are, but they are coming. Political affiliations then, Pete. Again, this is probably Gary's favourite question. You know, where, obviously, you know, you've talked about the clubs, you've talked about the sheer size and scale of Sao Paulo as a city, not only in Brazil, but in terms of in the continent. Political affiliations and clubs, is it rife? Is it there?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I think there's some great articles on this as well that deal with this particular issue. A lot of them do have kind of links with elites to start with. The original clubs that I talked about, all of them have links with the elites in different ways. You know, Paulistano, Mackenzie College, Germania, the Sao Paulo Athletic Club. Ipiranga was another team that I didn't actually mention. However, are different, you know, and so are Corinthians. There are a couple of clubs that originate from with much more working class ideals from the kind of more the masses, and they're two of the main ones. Juventus is the same. We've already talked about them being involved in, you know, workers from the textile mills. So again, Corinthians has got the most famous, you know, aspect of this. This is very much their identity they hold on to, that they were not founded by the upper class. They have people who were wall painters, who were shoemakers, a driver and a general labourer who first formed the club. And they very much kind of, they've held on to that identity. And that's in some way been enhanced by the Corinthians democracy period that I'm sure we'll come on to, which kind of very much stood up against the military dictatorship of the 60s and 70s. Corinthians with with you know, very famously Socrates and Casagrande, Valdemar, we're kind of standing up against this dictatorship. So that kind of identity of being against, you know, the elites, the institutions, has always been there. And that's kind of been in some ways almost augmented by the fact that Lula da Silva, who was president a while ago and is now president again after Bolsonaro, has been a lifelong Corinthians fan. For those who don't know, he's a very left-wing president. So he almost espouses that kind of idea of what Corinthians are in an identity fashion. Juventus have the same thing. Again, they're very much a club of the area called Mucca, which is a working class area. Ipiranga were known as the grandfathers of the Great Hill. Again, that was a particular area of Ipiranga of Sao Paulo, which was relatively working class. Sao Paulo's most interesting identity, the actual club Sao Paulo's most interesting identity, they're known as O Mais Querido, the most loved ones. And this is really because they represented the identity of the state and of the city. There was a period during a presidency of Getulio Vargas in the 1930s and 40s where he was trying to remove a sense of regionalism from the country because Brazil is vast. You know, it's got different identities. Rio is very different from Sao Paulo, is very different from Bahia, is very different from Goiás, and so on and so forth. But he was trying to erase this by emphasizing Brazilianness. And one of the, and therefore regional flags weren't allowed, but Sao Paulo would play in the red, white, and black of their particular state. So they got this identity of being the club of the state and of the region, and of, you know, very popular for that reason. Palmeiras used to be called Palestra Italia. They were the club of the Italian migrants, much like Audax Italiano, which we talked about in Santiago. What was interesting about that was that the Italian consulate tried to bring together all of the different Italian migrants that were in, and they all had different clubs for a while. And they were based, you know, a lot of the migrants came from different regions of Italy. And maybe at the time that they actually migrated, Italy wasn't really unified or wasn't firmly unified. So actually, one of the jobs of the Italian consulate was trying to help create a club that would actually bring all these Italian migrants together under one kind of club. And that's why they were called Palestra Italia. They actually became Palmeiras because during World War II, Brazil joined the war on the Allied side. And therefore, Palestra Italia had this identity problem of suddenly being associated with Brazil's enemies. So they were forced to kind of change their name because Getulio Vargas, the president I've just mentioned, said that you couldn't have any name that was related to these Axis powers. So that's when Palestra Italia changed their name to Palmeiras. I think we've mentioned all the other ones. Portuguesa have the identity of being a Portuguese migrant community. That's very much embedded within their kind of identity and their history as well. Then Nacional, again, are another club that were originally founded by British employees of the railway company. They do have a kind of a mascot who looks like a railway worker blowing his whistle, just to kind of hold on to that particular identity. And again, there are loads of clubs that have got socialist, anarchist, communist kind of backgrounds, but they were very much clubs of the kind of amateur barrio community leagues. And there's lots of interesting stories about, you know, festivals being held with the football at the centre to try and espouse anarchist or socialist or communist values to the workers of those particular areas as well.
It's brilliant. It's so good. Gary, I'm really sorry. I've got another question here, which again is something that's just kind of popped in my head. Now, I know you're going to tell me you can't answer this question, and I'm okay with that, but I want you to have a go anyway.
Okay.
It's quite a big question. Do you think the sport of football is better off for being claimed by the working classes? Why?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yes, I think it is. And I guess it's because it's a game that can be played very simply. I mean, you know, cricket, you need wickets, you need bats. So it's like, I played football when I was a kid with a stone in the playground in school, with a tennis ball, with a football. I mean, I can't say I've ever played with the rolled up rags, but I know of lots of people who have. So it's just, I think it's a simple game. And I think it's because it's a fairly cheap game to play. It appeals to the working classes. It's the famous, you know, kids from the back streets. You know, I mean, Brazil's famous, obviously, of course. And I remember I wrote an article about Jimmy Johnston, and he said he come from the back streets of Glasgow, look pretty much like the players from Brazil come from the back streets of Brazilian cities. And it's easy to play. And I think, I guess, it's uncomplicated. When it's played well, Cruyff said that the best football is simplest football, although the simplest football is the most complicated thing to play. So yeah, I think, yes, is the short answer. I think it's taken, it's a game that the working classes, the poorer people in so many countries could claim as their own.
This is, again, going off topic. Are you tempted in any way to write, and Steve will jump all over this, to write a book of political inference and football?
That's me done. I'm not doing writing, any more writing books, and now I'm retired.
Okay, I'll leave Stephen to start whispering in a minute.
I've already stated on previous podcasts he needs to write them for his kids and then just put his kids' name on. It's absolutely fine. No one's listening. No one will know, Gary. No one will know. It's a great legacy to hand to them. Just saying, like, I'll always find a way. There's always a way.
We take a book away with me to read. I've got Simon Cooper's Football Against the Enemy, which is very much along that sort of line. And we recently spoke to, the guy who writes for Outside Right about his book about the Defiance.
Chris Lee.
So there's a lot of, it's a fairly sort of, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there about politics and football because it's such an easy mix because it's such a reflection of social, it's a reflection of the development of society.
I think you've got David Goldblatt's book as well, The Ball Is Round, has got a lot of historical and political kind of inferences, talk about it, how it's been used. I mean, again, you know, Matthew Brown's book about sport in Latin America, sports in South America is again a similar thing about the first kind of 40 years up to 1930. You know, I think there's a lot of books out there which deal with specific political inferences. I think what made Chris Lee's book so interesting, you know, and again, I read that, you know, I was interviewed for it as well, is how he picked a particular political movement and analysed how football counteracted fascism. Because actually, you know, there's been books about how football has been appropriated by fascism. So that kind of book about how fascism was counteracted through football as well was probably a very necessary book. It's a topic always of interest. I mean, we talk about football being a zero institution. It's there for anyone to be used. It's kind of like this empty vessel of power that you can put words in and kind of politics and social messages or racial messages or gender messages or peace messages will come out of it. So I think there's always room to look at how football is co-opted or co-opts, you know, and how it gets manipulated. I think what's interesting is that how other sports don't get talked about as much. That's a kind of, you know, a bit of a hole for me.
Well, I was going to ask Stephen, my question for Stephen was, I suppose similar to Gary's, is football better or worse off for this political inference that exists within it in 99% of the countries?
Oh, better. Far, far better. I mean, we've always discussed it, that you can't, you know, split the soup. You know, people who turn up and say, leave politics out of football, just have questionable politics. That's all it comes down to, frankly. That's all it ever comes down to. You know, people who say that, you know, just don't want their politics examining. You know, that's very much what it comes down to. But, yeah, football's much better for it and always will be.
Yeah, brilliant. I'm glad we've nailed that one.
If any Tories are listening.
Go on. Keep out. You know,
kind of piss off.
Yeah,
just I did say it could turn on very quickly.
I knew it just needed the right question. I knew I'd get there. I knew I'd get there eventually.
I've given you 34 minutes of good behaviour.
You have, and then we threw in politics, and I knew that would
already,
be the one.
I've already told Tories.
So moving on, Pete. Like I said, this is the bit that I like, and it's the silverware, it's the domestic and the continental success or lack of success, or what is probably my most favourite, is so close to success but just not quite making it. So, and again, in terms of this city and its size and its scale, you know, where do the clubs sit? You know, domestically, where is the hierarchy, even just within the city? Where is it within the country? But then on top of that is where does Sao Paulo sit in terms of South American football and South American, much, much dominance, but in terms of having its say?
Much like if we start with kind of the success, if we start with kind of the city or the state league, because they play in a state league, and this is where Santos also appear, a club we haven't mentioned, because they're not in the city of Sao Paulo, but they're nearby. So in terms of the Sao Paulo League, the Liga Paulista, The top dogs are Corinthians. They've got 30 trophies. Palmeiras is kind of next with 24, Sao Paulo with 22. So they're the top dogs there. In terms of the Brasileirão, the kind of national tournament, we can look here at Sao Paulo teams having the edge over Rio de Janeiro fairly substantially. So this is where we turn off our Rio de Janeiro fans by saying that Sao Paulo has done better nationally. Palmeiras have the most trophies here with 11. Corinthians are third most, Santos were second. So then again, we've got the top three are all kind of Sao Paulo teams. Corinthians are fifth. Flamengo are the Rio team that kind of breaks up the top five. Portuguese have been runners-up once in 1996. So again, you know, that's worthy of praise. So that's the kind of thing in terms of nationally, Sao Paulo teams tend to do better than Rio de Janeiro. Now, there are slightly reasons for that as well, but we won't go into those because it'll take too long. In terms of the Copa Libertadores, again, we've got quite a lot of success. You know, all of them have won it. Corinthians have won it in 2012, beating Boca Juniors. Palmeiras are the team who've actually played in the Libertadores most from Brazil. They beat Deportivo Cali in 1999. They were runners-up to Boca in 2000, lost on penalties. And then most recently, they beat Santos 1-0 in 2020 and 2021, beat Flamengo. So again, Palmeiras have done well recently. Sao Paulo have actually got the kind of most storied history, probably, I'd say. They're runners-up in 1974, the first kind of, you know, of the Sao Paulo clubs to really get that success. Won it in 1992, retained it in 1993, beating Newell's Old Boys and Católica. Again, two clubs we've talked about fairly recently in other episodes. Runners-up in 1994, just failed to get the kind of hat-trick that Independiente had managed. Semi-finalists a couple of times in 2004, then won it the next year, beating Atlético Paranaense in 2005. Lost the final in 2006 to Internacional, again, another club we've talked about from Porto Alegre. And then two semi-finals in 2010 and 2016. Sao Paulo are the only team to have won the Copa Sudamericana as well in 2012. And again, they've all done fairly well in the Intercontinental. Again, the club, the competition that South America counts as being much more important than the European teams. Mostly because the European teams didn't tend to win it very often. So, you know, it was always an excuse to say, oh, no, we don't care. We don't care. We don't care about it. But yeah, Sao Paulo beat Cruyff Barcelona back in 92, 2-1. Beat AC Milan in 1993, 3-2. So again, there's two of the biggest scalps you can possibly get. But of course, it didn't matter to those European clubs. Palmeiras did lose to Man United in 1999, which I don't think really mattered to the Brazilian team on that occasion. They weren't trying very hard against Man United. And then Sao Paulo beat Liverpool 1-0. The goalkeeper didn't actually score, but was MVP in that one. And then Corinthians beat Chelsea 1-0. So two of our co-commentators tonight are pretty not feeling great about their particular club's successes against these Sao Paulo teams.
All I can say is the Sao Paulo teams are lucky that Hull City haven't come up against Hull City in the Intercontinental Cup, because then they really would be in trouble.
Just jumping into it still for a brief there, when Flamengo won the Copa Libertadores in the big Flamengo 2-1, they went on to the World Cup club final, and we beat them. Chelsea beat them, so that's it.
My question for you on this, Gary, is, you know, obviously we've done 15 cities. Ultimately, when these cities sit around the table, they don't. But when they listen to our podcast, because I'm sure they all do.
Of course.
Is it medals on the table that ultimately will dictate which is the most either successful city, if you want to combine your clubs together, or is it something else that's a bit more indefinable and sort of almost untouchable? What is it that really decides or defines the most successful South
if we're
American
talking
city?
About, you know, between the cities, if we're talking between the cities, we've probably got to sort of come away from the States, I suppose, a little bit as well. So I suppose, you know, it is the medals, but which medals? And I suppose we're talking about the Copa Libertadores, we're talking about the Sudamericana. Those are the ones that sort of define them. And in Brazil, you've got Brazil area. So, I mean, I think, yeah, it probably is the medals on the table, but it's which medals that make the difference. I think, you know, I suppose, you know, you could look at success outside of the continent in the, you know, the Club World Cup and all that sort of thing. But I think the Copa Libertadores is still it's the gold standard, isn't it, really?
And again, Steve, you know, this is something we've chatted about, and how the competition, the Copa Libertadores, is more and more becoming a two-country realistically, it's becoming a two-country competition with any of the other, either the cities that we've talked about, the other eight countries, I think, that form the South America Files of Countries. You know, it really is reducing and reducing and reducing in terms of potential winners.
It is. It's shrinking. And that's just the power of money, basically. It's where the power bases are. And it's sadly the way it works. You know, what are we buying Munich? Is it 11 successive Bundesliga titles? You know, the hegemonies and the monopolies, you know, across domestic football are becoming, you know, more protrusive. You know, we've always seen it somewhere along the line, be it Scotland. You know, we don't have to look back, look north to Scotland. And what are we now? 1986, was it last time? No, 1985, I think the last time, you know, a team won the title up there that wasn't Rangers or Celtic. You know, huge amounts of domination of the likes of Olympiakos in Greece and, you know, many other nations that have this and always have. And it is sad to see South America, you know, start to conform in that respect. You know, it just denotes stepping stones to, you know, continental and global super leagues to come. You know, I think you can't stop that, because people are just, they are going to get tired of just seeing the same teams winning competitions over and over and over again. You know, don't talk to my dad's next door neighbour yesterday, who's, you know, been an Everton season ticket holder for years and years and years. And, you know, he said, I've not watched a game of football in a year now. You know, basically because, you know, yeah, he said, I've put up with the travails of Everton. He said, it's not, you know, they've been crap for years. He said, you know, he's quite self-depreciating in that respect. That's not my words. They are the words of Bernard Cleveland, next door, who lives next door to me. But, you know, he said, I've put up with a lot, you know, but he said it's more a case of, you know, the buy success and you know, what's the point, you know, basically. And, you know, he's you know, when you hear people like that who are lifelong football lovers and active football goers as well, we're not just talking armchair fans here, sorry, all armchair fans who have now alienated along with Tory voters. Good God, if you're an armchair Tory voter, then you've absolutely nothing down for you.
Thrown rather than armchair, isn't it?
I'm coming round to throw eggs at your windows very, very soon. So, yeah, you know, it is a shame that it's coming to that, you know. But, you know, if it has to come to that, then, you know, Sao Paulo have put them, you know, they've made themselves a power base. You know, certainly in relatively recent times as well. You know, as mentioned, they don't have that kind of, you know, back catalogue that goes back all those years. You know, we're looking at Corinthians didn't win a Libertadores until 2012, was it? You know, Sao Paulo, you know, 92 and 93. So that's now the 90s, you know, Palmeiras, you know, from 99 onwards. You know, they're all relatively nouveau riche in that respect. You know, we're not talking about, you know, the iconic names of the likes of, you know, your River Plates and your, you know, Estudiantes and all of those that go back to the era of the dark arts, shall we say, and all of that. You know, these are relative newcomers. In a way, these represent, you know, I don't know, it almost chalks them up in a way as South American versions, although they've got proud histories and, you know, in domestic terms. In kind of international terms, they're a kind of a PSG, and you know, it's like watching PSG. You know, the inevitable of PSG joining Manchester City in being a Champions League winner. The kind of there's a bit of Chelsea in that. Sorry, Gary, I've gone for Gary.
Oh my God, he's on it now.
Those teams who win a Champions League and never won a European Cup, put it that way. I'll throw that into the equation. Yeah, you know, there's two sides of the coin there. Right, I'm going to back out now, very, very slowly.
Stephen's address will be supplied at the end of this podcast for anyone who's remotely interested or still listening.
I would like to say that Gary is not an armchair Tory as well. So, you know, it's not all bad.
Wow.
Sun lounger, you know, yeah. Given where Gary lives, you know.
That really went somewhere that I didn't think it was going. Apologies to half the South American population.
That's been an edgy 12 minutes. We're at 46 minutes now. That's been edgy. I'll try and revert to behaviour. Good behaviour. No,
it's okay. Like I say, just this is a free swing. It's a free swing episode for everyone. It's big game time. So again, you know, the clubs that Pete's mentioned, the clubs that you know you've done your research on, and you know, the sort of the games that have come either to define the club or define the city, you know, it can be, you know, games against, you know, clubs in the city. But I'm going to start with you, Gary. It's your series. It's your brainchild. You can have the first pick of, have you got more than one?
Yeah, I've spent seven, actually.
Yeah. Okay, right. So you pick as many as you want of the big games.
Okay. Well, I mentioned this club earlier. It's Cerro Cayetano. When it formed in December 1989, and by 2002, they got promoted from the third tier to the second tier very quickly. And 2002, they qualified for the Copa Libertadores. They topped the group. And the round of 16, they beat Universidad Católica 4-2 on pens. Then they beat Peñarol 3-1 on pens. In the semis, they beat América of the Mexican team. And they played Olimpia of Paraguay in the final. This is a team that had only didn't exist 12 years before this. And they lost the final on pens to Olimpia after a 2-2 draw on aggregate. So they came close to winning the Copa Libertadores a dozen years after they were formed. But just a couple of other sort of things about that the club. In 2007, they were on the decline in 2007. I'll come back and tell you why in a second. But they finished third in the league, qualified for the semi-finals of the Campeonato Paulista. And they beat Sao Paulo 5-2 to get to the final, played Santos. They won 2-0 at home and lost 2-0 away. So you think, oh, playoff time or whatever. No, Santos were going to award the title because they had a better overall league record. So they lost on that. The other game I was going to mention, the main game I was going to mention, was in they played in the Campeonato Brasileiro Serie A, which at the time was called the Copa Joe Avalanche. And it was also constructed in a weird way. They had like a mini tournament. And so they basically picked one team from the third division, the third tier, three from the second tier and 12 from the first tier to make the 16 clubs up. Cerro Cayetano finished as runners-up in the second division, so they qualified via that. And so they played Fluminense, beat them, round 16. Palmeiras beat them in their quarters. Grêmio beat them to get to the final against Vasco da Gama. And it's played over two legs, and the first leg was played at Cerro Cayetano's ground, and it ended in 1-1 draw. In the replay, so the second leg at Vasco da Gama's ground, there was a massive crowd invasion. The game was abandoned. And basically, the Brazilian FA were going to award the game to Cerro Cayetano because of Vasco's fault. But they appealed, and the game was actually replayed, and they won. Vasco won 3-1, and so they won the title. So another close shave. But what started their decline was in October 27, 2004. They were playing against Sao Paulo, and there's a guy called Serginho playing for them, and he suffered a fatal heart attack during the game. And apparently, because it was decided that Cerro Cayetano's staff had let Serginho play, even though they knew he had heart trouble, the club was penalised. And it's been a marked decline in the club that in 1989 was formed, in 2002 got to the Copa Libertadores final. And at the end of this season, they finished 11th in the second tier. Just an amazing little story.
Good choice, Gary. Good final choice. Stephen, you can go next.
I'm going to go for Lightning striking twice. Palmeiras doing for Corinthians, you know, quarterfinals of the 99 Copa Libertadores on penalties after 2-0s. You know, went to a penalty shootout that Palmeiras edged. And then a year later, they went at it again in the semi-finals. A little bit more expansive on that occasion. You know, Corinthians won the first leg 4-3. Palmeiras, you know, fought back to win the second leg 3-2 for a 6-6 aggregate. And then edged it in a 9-goal penalty shootout thriller. You know, I think one of the big things about big city football and big city rivalries is when you play a team, a rival city team, at, you know, a big pronounced occasion, you know, the biggest kind of occasion that you've had, and you come out on top. You know, that is such a kind of, like, it's just such a hold over your City rivals. You know, as a Liverpool supporter, you know, it's from the perspective of winning two FA Cup finals against Everton and a League Cup final as well. Sorry, Everton.
How did you find the FA Cup final this season?
I totally ignored it, to be honest. totally ignored it.
Yeah, I thought you might.
Along with the Champions League final as well, doesn't it come to that? I had a lovely day on the
sunshine. Season finished early for you.
To be fair, I would put my hands up and say I've not watched a televised FA Cup final in about 10 years since Wigan beat Man City. I think that was the last one I watched on television. The only FA Cup finals I've actually watched in the last decade are the ones that Liverpool have been at. I think that's only one across that period of time. That concept of beating your City rival, you know, it's a bit like, you know, River Plate always holding over Boca Juniors that Libertadores success. You know, the sense of peril of playing of your City rival on a big, big, big occasion, you know, a trophy occasion, or, you know, a semi-final when there's something massively tangible at play. You know, every derby game's, you know, got that edge to it. But when you throw in, you know, a piece of silverware or the hint of a piece of silverware, the sense of peril is, you know, unless you've lived it, it's impossible to truly, you know, give you an insider's view of that. But it's like nothing else. You know, it really is gut-wrenching. You know, that fear of being turned over by your big City rivals on the biggest day of the year, you know, is absolutely massive. And for these two games within the space of 12 months, you know, four games, the two legged games, both to boil down to penalty shootouts, you know, and both to have gone Palmeiras' way. Absolutely, you know, stunning exchange of football over the course of a year, with two massive prizes on offer. Now, as it was, Palmeiras didn't go on to win the 2000, copper. You know, but just massive, massive occasions.
Excellent, great choice, Pete. The last big games of the series.
Okay, I'll do a couple of quick ones. In 1949, as you'll all remember, Nacional were playing Sao Paulo in the Paulista League, and apparently it was being refereed by a guy called Mr. Snape, who somehow managed to score two goals for the Sao Paulo team. Now, I've only found this in one place. I've been trying to corroborate it, but sadly, kind of, whenever I look up Snape referee, you know, it tends to go to links to Quidditch and Harry Potter. But apparently that did happen. 1968, apparently, as well, Nacional were playing against Jundiaí when a bomb was thrown at the Nacional players. And actually, they went back to change them and turned up half an hour later and finished the game, drew 1-1. So made a stern stuff, the Nacional lads. Portuguesa were playing against Botafogo in a Rio versus Sao Paulo cup match. So it was a bit of a kind of state derby, interstate derby. And, you know, arguably the ref might have had a few difficulties controlling the players, as all 22 players were sent off, which apparently was a record at the time. You know, don't know what happened. Again, couldn't track down the story of exactly what happened. But again, you know, somewhere in the Brazilian archive, there's a story about exactly what that is. I think what's really cool about something we haven't really spoken about enough, really, I don't think, is the names of all the derbies that there are in the cities. And I'll just kind of finish talking about the names of the derbies here. Firstly, the Corinthians Palmeiras is just known as the Derby Paulista. So that's the boring one, the Paulista Derby. Corinthians versus Sao Paulo is known as the Majestic, the Majestuoso. Corinthians Santos, again, Santos not in Sao Paulo, but obviously near, that's known as the Clásico Alvinegro, the black and white derby, because both teams play in black and white. Palmeiras Santos is known as the Clásico da Saudade, the Good Times Classic. What else have we got? Sao Paulo versus Corinthians, I've already said that one. We've got Portuguesa versus Corinthians is the Clásico dos Invictos, the classic of the unbeaten ones. Portuguesa against Palmeiras is the Clásico das Colónias, the classic of the colonies, because obviously they were formed by Portuguese and Italian migrants. Portuguesa versus Juventus is the derby dos imigrantes, the derby of the immigrants, not the colonies. They're only immigrants, not colonies, for again similar reasons. And then finally, oh no, Portuguesa Sao Paulo is the Norte Sul Paulistano, the North South Paulistano. But the best one probably is the Palmeiras Sao Paulo, which is known as O Choque Rei, the Clash of Kings. And again, there's been lots of classic derbies over the years that probably have earned it that name.
You see, the Merseyside derby, it needs something better, Stephen. It needs a better name. The Liverpool Everton derby needs a better name.
I'll come up with something.
Excellent. Yeah, brilliant. No problem. That wasn't a joke. I wasn't putting you on the spot to come up with that then, by the way.
It's no classic coast. The Hampshire Sussex cricket derby, the classic coast. One of the great inventions of our times, you know. So it's like the old farm derby of the Norwich Ipswich, again, another classic, so the modern day.
Perhaps it's called the Merseyside derby, the Scousico.
Scousico. I remember someone calling it El Scalico at one point as well.
Okay, well, we can work on that, guys. That's great. Okay, players and managers then. So final topic as we go through this. It's the players, the great players, the great managers who at some point have been in Sao Paulo, have either made their name there, started there, gone back there, at some point have travelled through the city as part of their careers. Gary, we'll start with you if you want.
I've got quite a few players. I'll just dip into some interesting ones because obviously you can imagine the size of these clubs, they've had some outstanding players playing for them. So starting with Palmeiras, Roberto Carlos, Rivaldo, we'll start Mirandinha, who had a spell at Newcastle, also played for Palmeiras. And I remember a guy called Luis Pereira, who, after being sent off against Holland in the 1974 World Cup, decided he was going to take on the entire crowd in a fight. So that's interesting. Juninho, who Middlesbrough's little fella, who played there, then John Los Santos as well. Moving on to Sao Paulo. Obviously, your mate, Stu, Tele Santana, had a fantastic period there in the 90s, winning trophy after trophy after trophy. And Bela Gutman was coach there for a while, as well, the famous Portuguese, who managed Benfica the last time they won a European trophy and cursed the club. Players there, Rogério Ceri, the eccentric goalkeeper, and a guy called Muller. I don't know if you remember the guy called Muller, who played for Brazil against England a couple of times. And he actually played for six clubs. In six Sao Paulo clubs, Sao Paulo, Corinthians, Palmeiras, Sao Caetano, Portuguesa, and Fernandópolis towards the end of his career. Kaká played for them as well, Cafu, Careca, Danielson, and who was once the most expensive player in the world, and Falcao. Briefly, Corinthians, Daniel Passarella played for them, was interesting, I thought. That's a great players who played for Portuguesa. Gér, who was part of the Grande Inter team in the 60s, played for Portuguesa, and Mirandinha, the guy from Newcastle, played there, and Muller, obviously, and Vava, who was a part of the World Cup team in 1958. Roberto Dynamite, he exploded onto the scene there on a loan deal. He went down a bomb, apparently. Regis Pitbull, although he was normally a forward, apparently he was a bit of a terrier in midfield. Boro, penned a contract in 1990. Elvis Pereira only played seven games for the club, but apparently when he left, the club was all shook up.
Wow. Well, brilliant. Yeah, great choices, Gary, and with added humour as well, even better. Stephen, I'll let you, any more you want to add? There's got to be a Liverpool player somewhere, is there?
Don't think there is, actually. Oh. Yeah, I could be wrong there, but yeah. What I was looking at was kind of like some of the World Cup winners as well. You know, Gary's gone across some of them, but, you know, Rivellino amongst them. You know, he's a boy of Sao Paulo. There was also Gilmar, who still is the only goalkeeper to be back-to-back starting winning World Cup goalkeeper from 58 and 62. Zito, Djalma Santos, you know, were part of those two sides who, you know, they were, you know, sons of Sao Paulo themselves. I mean, interesting that with Sao Paulo, its importance now, and, you know, we've spoke of how football's kind of like the success is condensed, and, you know, Sao Paulo were kind of like quite thriving in that respect. was that the Sao Paulo influence kind of drifted somewhat over the years at international level. You know, but it's kind of like potential for it to come back. I mean, Felix as well, 1970, you know, much maligned goalkeeper. But, you know, it's amazing to think that Brazil's first three World Cup winning goalkeepers all came from Sao Paulo. And then further up the pitch, you know, you can even throw in, the much maligned Serginho, the weak link of the perceived weak link of the 1982 World Cup squad. Stu really needs to write a book about that. But yes, you know, and in terms of managers, you know, Vicente Fiola, you know, who always fascinates me, you know, as a coach, you know, he was Brazil's World Cup winning coach in 58, took them on again to England in 66, two very contrasting World Cups there, but was the man entrusted to take them into Europe, should have coached them at the 62 World Cup, but had to withdraw due to ill health. You know, a portly fellow, I think we could call him, not, you know, the most natural physique for someone that is so football minded, but wasn't a player himself, certainly not to any great degree. But you know, Fiola, you know, massively popular with his players, but hugely unpopular with journalists. I think he was notorious for giving them short shrift and you know, calling it as he saw it, and not playing the game, shall we say? So yes. No, they are my cards to throw on the table.
Excellent. Now, Pete, come on, you must have people from the 1860s in here.
Of course, naturally. Excellent. So I'll start with probably the first great Brazilian striker and probably the guy that blazed the trail for a lot of Brazilians, a guy called Arthur Friedenreich, who played for Paulistano, he played for Ipiranga. He has a disputed record of apparently scoring 1,329 goals in 1,239 games. Now, that is hotly disputed. But what is really important is he was known as the Tiger or the Black Pearl, and that second nickname gives an idea about why he was important. Because he's playing as the son of a black washerwoman, a black washerwoman and a German father. Because of his mixed race, he often had to change in different changing rooms along with the Paulistano elite. He was an elite club. That's why he did slightly better at Ipiranga, who were more of a working-class team. Because he was such a good player, the elite clubs eventually would accept him in. But he wasn't allowed to kind of change them. He wasn't allowed to go to functions with them. He actually used to put kind of rice powder on his face to try and whiten himself so he was acceptable to footballing authorities at the time. So he was one of the great players, but he wasn't allowed to play in the 1921 South American Championships to be hosted in Argentina because the Brazilian government didn't want to send players that were black or mixed race because they were worried about presenting themselves as a nation of blacks. And there was this huge controversy of the Buenos Aires press presenting the team as monkeys in a newspaper previous to the tour. So Arturo Friedenreich was denied the chance to play in that particular tournament because of that. But he was seen as being a kind of a pioneer of the Jogo Bonito. He was top scorer of the Sao Paulo League lots and lots of times. Some of the other great figures of the past for Corinthians, there was a goalkeeper with the very Brazilian name of Tuffy. Didn't quite do as well as his mates on the nickname front. But he was also nicknamed as Satan, because he used to wear black in goal. And he had this apparently extreme talent of saving penalties. He once apparently asked for a hat to help him save a penalty from a fan in the crowd. And he was rumoured as well. He was famous for, after making a save, throwing it back to the forward so they can have another go. He's also known as the goalkeeper that football forgot because apparently he was bribed to lose a match against Corinthians. And therefore his kind of legend kind of, you know, fell into disrepute after that. The first player of the great hero of Corinthians was a guy called Nickel, who scored 243 goals to the club. Another of these famously indisciplined players, but apparently was the first player to have a bust or a statue made of him at the ground. So he was the kind of first of many greats for that particular club. Going back to Gary's Biro Biro, he once won 80,000 votes in an election as a protest against the military dictatorship. And actually has a rice dish named after him as well. And he played in the same kind of era as Socrates. Again, we've hardly talked about Socrates on this pod, but again, one of the great players for Corinthians alongside Casagrande and Vladimir. There's a really good book by Andrew Downey about him, as lots of people will know. I mean, there's so many great players. Let's talk about Gerson, one of the great kind of players, Brazilian midfielders in the 60s and 70s. He was a hero of Sao Paulo. One of the great holding midfield playmakers and passers. Became slightly infamous because he was on a Villa Rica cigarette advert, which he had a tagline, "I like to take advantage of everything," right, which kind of slightly resounded with issues of corruption and bribery in the game. So he was regretted being part of that advert. He also was really angry to not be named in Pelé's top 100 players of South America. And when he was asked about it, he ripped it up. I think they're the main one. I mean, there are so many players. One of the guys that would make a great book, and again, I think there's a great book about much-travelled Hungarian football coaches, is Bela Gutmann. We've talked about Georgi Orth. In South America, he's known as Jorge Orth. Bela Gutmann is another one of the same thing. He went to Sao Paulo in the 1950s. So again, there must be a great story here about how these kind of trailblazing Hungarian coaches who had kind of revolutionized Central American football, brought their football to new audiences in South America and the influence they had. So maybe that's a book for another time. Yeah, that'd probably do it, I think. And there's also, you know, another sweet player we haven't mentioned was Cacau, who played for Nacional. So there we go. One last puntastic bit to add to kind of Gary's list. Left a nice taste.
Okay, guys. So we've done 15 cities. Obviously, we're finishing in Brazil. So I've got two questions for you. You're not allowed a lot of thinking time, so be aware. My first question to you is, when people say football in Brazil, which do you think is the city that people think of first? Pete?
It's Rio, but it should be Sao Paulo, given
the situation. Oh, you can't have a should be.
And it is Rio.
Just because you want to protect yourself from the Sao Paulo match.
No, but it's Rio. It's the image, isn't it? It's Rio.
Stephen?
It's Rio. You know, that's not necessarily making it right, but that's just the reset image that people have in their head.
Okay, good. So that was your warm-up. So now we've been right across South America. When people say to you, South American football, what is your city?
Oh, God. I mean, yeah, this is my academic area, Stu. Literally so unfair. I mean, for me, the one that's interested me most all throughout this series has been Santiago and Cali. That's the one that I've really, really enjoyed researching. There's so many stories. And then Montevideo in a close second for me. That's just based on my interest and how much I've learned, I'm guessing.
That's okay. Stephen?
I'm going to go for Pete's second choice, the Montevideo. I'm going to enjoy just the lunacy of the place and everything. Buenos Aires is very, very close there. But I'm gonna go to the other side of the river and drop into Montevideo. You know, first World Cup final. You know, what more can you do? You know, it is, I don't know, it's the root of South American football as far as the global view of it is concerned.
Excellent. Great answer, guys. So I'm gonna parachute you in to Sao Paulo, but I'm not gonna leave you there. But in Sao Paulo, whereabouts are you all watching your football? Gary, where are you watching your football?
I think because of my sort of, you know, political sort of attitude, I think Corinthians has got to be the one. I've got the phrase here that they used, and Portuguese is really difficult pronunciation. It's Ganhar ou Perder, mas sempre com democracia. So I win or lose, always with democracy.
I can see why you've gone for that, Gary. Yeah, well done. Great choice. Stephen, where are you watching your football?
A time machine needed, but Albion, who disappeared in the 1930s, I'm going for them. They have the funkiest kit. They don't. There's no one with a discernible sash in this godforsaken city.
I can't believe we picked them to do as a city. If I'd known that, we'd just took it off.
There is no, after all this, there's no sash at the end. But they did have a kit that was kind of like red, white, and blue in it, and it kind of looks, it's if you find it online, it looks a bit like the LWT theme tune thing.
Oh, I love that. On the Saturday night.
Yeah, kind of like the big match or whatever.
Oh,
you know,
brilliant.
So I'm going for the LWT connections to Albion.
Brilliant. Pete, where are you watching your football?
I mean, yeah, this is a tricky one. I think using a time machine, the obvious choice is to go and watch the lads of Scottish Wanderers play. You know, I mean, if you're going to Brazil, you know, what you really want to see is a team of Scottish expats booting it up in the air, you know, on their breaks off from working at the textile mill. That's what we dream of. You know, that's what you know, these kind of images of glorious football. I mean, apart from all
of them being ginger and struggling with the sunshine.
I was
as well.
Just about to say it's going to be,
it will be a sight to behold.
Every game kicks off at 8 o'clock in the evening, just to avoid kind of, you know, horrible skin peeling off and kind of stuff. I mean, you know, I think that AA Guanabara were a very, you know, were a big choice as well. We could have gone for Antarctica, you know, the club of the beer brewery. Again, we've talked about breweries previously. I think if it had to be a modern day team, though, again, without the time machine, I'd probably pop along with Gareth at Corinthians.
Okay, final question then, guys. Now we've finished, I can parachute you anywhere you want in South America to watch your football. It can be any club, any era, anything that we've talked about. We'll go in reverse order this time. So, Pete, you can be airdropped into anywhere from now on to watch your football.
I think that if I want to watch football in any city where it means the most, probably, and where you've got the most variety of types of football and most kind of, you know, cool stories, and where it's probably easiest to get around to watch it all, it's probably, I'm heading to Montevideo. And I'm probably going either, you know, 1960s, maybe when, you know, the Peñarol are at their height with the, you know, Clásicos against Nacional. Or I'm probably going back to the kind of 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, when Uruguayan football is arguably the best in the world with, you know, 1924 Olympics, 1928 Olympics, 1930 World Cup. There's so many teams. They're all in Montevideo. You can probably just, you know, hop on the tram, you know, and watch another club, you know, pretty much, you know, every afternoon. So I think I'm heading to Montevideo to watch my football. I haven't been there as well, so that's where I'd like to go.
Excellent. Stephen, for you, where would you like to be parachuted into?
I'm with Peace. I'm off to Montevideo. A little bit 1960s, like you said, you know, where the needle is the highest, where they're going above the knee, most definitely, you know. And but with a bit of the 1930s in there, just to be at the kind of like the very first World Cup would be, you know, absolutely phenomenal to be able to just, like, you know, drop yourself into that.
And Gary, for you, it's the final question, the final thought. After everything we've done, the miles we've travelled in both series, where am I leaving you behind?
You can drop me into the Bombonera and I'd like to see Boca play River Plate. That would be great. That was, you know, I mean, one game you could go to on the bucket list, that would be it. So I'd go to the Boca River Super Classico.
Brilliant. And that, guys, is where we will finish the South America finals. All 50-odd thousand miles of it, countless problems with KCOM and everything else that's gone on that we've had to battle through. I want to say enjoyed it. I'll ask you all of those things in a minute. But obviously, Gary, like I say, this was your idea, your brainchild about 9.5 years ago. Has it gone how you hoped it would and how you thought it would?
It hasn't gone how I hoped it would. It's gone so much better. So much better because we've had so much fun. I mean, I never learned so much from Pete. And, you know, we've had chats about different discussions that we've sort of struck off on tangents. But it's been so much fun. I don't think I've laughed on as many podcasts as I have on this series. So, you know, this is obviously why we don't want to give it up. So just picking up what we said earlier, a lot of the clubs in South America, they're multi-sport clubs. So, you know, they've got, they'll play football, they'll play cricket, they'll play rugby, some have got rowing, some have even got chess. But what we haven't got in South America is a five-a-side continental competition. So in our next series, what we're going to be doing is preempting that will come along following our series. It will be started by South America. We're going to pick five-a-side teams for each of the countries across South America. and debate who we'll pick from from each of us, and which players will get in and which players won't get in. So we're going to be back soon with South America Files, the next series. It's five, which I think it is the fifth series. It's five aside, so I think that's quite handy as well.
Oh, it's like we've planned it. It's like we've thought about it. Okay then. So it's not the end.
Never the end.
It'll never end.
It's last tour.
I'm gonna have to drag you out of Buenos Aires and come and find Pete and Stephen somewhere in Montevideo and get the five-a-side team sorted. Stephen, first of all, enjoyed this one. Second of all, looking forward to the new one.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. More chance for more edginess and danger ahead. You know, I can't imagine going back to being, you know, actually kind of like totally respectful about these. I think I'd miss some kind of South. I need my South American hit. It's great. It's like having a stress ball.
Oh, the stress ball of podcasts.
It is the stress ball of podcasts.
Brilliant. And that's how we'll market it. That's how we'll market this. Obviously, Pete, special mention has to go to you, because otherwise there'd be no South America Files. It would be Gary, Stephen and I chatting about what we did at the weekend, pretty much, and then the odd nod to a little bit of South American football, and that would be it. You have been, continue to be incredible with your knowledge, with how you get it, how you put your points across, how you make it so informative but so entertaining. It is just... It's brilliant by you. I know we're on the podcast, but really the podcast is all about you. It really is. Whether you like it or not, it really is.
Oh, that's very kind. I think, you know, the amazing thing, but also amazingly frustrating thing is, with all the research that I've been doing with all the countries and clubs, there are so many kind of strings that I want to write about now. You know, there just isn't enough time. There's books that I've got, like scribbled notes, say, you know, about Georgi Orth and Bella Gutman and other foreign coaches. There's loads of histories that I want to write from all these cities. I want to go and investigate archives in Montevideo and Santiago and Guayaquil. You know, there's so many stories that, and so many really interesting facets of club and local community histories and the impact of immigration and what's going politically and socially with these clubs. There's so many stories to be written. And, you know, I hope that I probably won't get to write them. You know, there are various other historians, you know, in this field, Matthew Brown, Mark Orton, you know, lots of other people that do this stuff as well, who are really great at what they do. And again, just hope that other people are maybe inspired by the kind of things we're talking about to go, you know, one day maybe start a PhD, you know, start a book and, you know, go out to these kind of places, go out to newspaper archives, go and look in club museums, go and look around these community clubs and tell the stories in a lot more detail, because there are so many stories out there and it's great fun introducing them, sharing some of them. And, you know, I hope that they get explored a lot further. That's the cool and exciting thing about the work that I get to do. So, brilliant. Yeah.
And to be fair, it's something we talk about a lot, is keeping stories alive and making sure they stay in the conscious of future generations. I absolutely agree. So Gary, are we calling it South America Files, the five? What are we calling it? What are we calling the new one?
I don't know. I was thinking about this earlier. I mean, let's call it South America Files, the fiver, because it's the fifth one as well. I mean, I don't know. We'll have a think about it, and I mean, we'll talk about five-a-side football, and I don't know. I think the fiver sounds a bit right.
I'll tell you what it could be. Yeah, there's loads of all across the continent. There are different names for the kickabout. You know, it feels like we're talking about five-a-side here. You know, we want to kind of pick the perfect kind of word for the kickabout. So I'll have to go and research what all of the different ones are. I saw a map with all the different words for the pick-up football game, the kickabout. So, yeah, maybe we can pick one of those.
Please pick one that's easy to say, Pete. If I've got to say this every week and it's something that's really complicated, please don't stitch me up.
Well, that makes it even more fun to be able to do that,
and especially if it needs an accent and all of those things as well. That would just be a nightmare. Okay, all right, so for now it's the end, but obviously it's not literally the end, which I like Gary said, makes me really happy too, because I love this series and this concept. Thank you as always. For those of you who haven't been offended, thanks for listening. But I'm sure we'll have offended you at some point in one of the episodes.
Even if you have been offended, thanks for listening and seeing it through to the end. You've gained kind of like my respect if you've managed to do that.
If you're still listening, yeah. I would say I apologise on Stephen's behalf, but I'm actually not.
I'm not sorry.
I'm not sorry. I know, which is why I'm not doing it. thanks for listening. We will be back, fully offensive as always, for the new series, which Pete's going to name in a really simple way for us. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you, and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.